You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 16 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. If this is the first episode you've come across in the series, make sure that you subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember that you can find us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/socialmediaandpoliticspodcast. All right, y'all. Thanks again for tuning in. And before I dive into the topic of today's episode, I've got a couple of announcements and a little bit of housekeeping to do. First, thanks to Dr. Anna Maria Ducek-Segestin, who guest-hosted our last episode on a set of anti-corruption protests in Romania, which, if you've been paying attention to the news, soon after we released that episode, there was a set of anti-corruption protests in Russia. I don't know if that's connected to the launch of the Social Media and Politics podcast, but that's something for Vladimir Putin and his goons to figure out. Secondly, the Social Media and Politics Podcast Snapchat filter is now live. You can find some pictures of it on our Twitter page and our Facebook page. And if you are a student or member of a faculty at a university in the U.S. and you'd like us to geotarget your campus or your dorm, shoot us a tweet and we'll do that. It's pretty cost effective and can only be done in the U.S. And thirdly, just so that you're kept up with our release schedule, I've been releasing episodes about every 2 weeks. And I'm starting to get a little bit of a backlog in material. So at least for the near future, I'll be releasing episodes every week on Sunday or Monday evenings. And I can already reveal that our next episode is going to be on the impact of social media on politics in Nigeria. And after that, we're going to be looking at hidden social networks. So what's going on platforms like WhatsApp, Kick, Wicker, that are encrypted or don't have a main broadcasting feature like Facebook and Twitter. So to get those when they drop, make sure that you're subscribed on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, whichever is your preferred platform. And while you're at it, tell a friend and get them in a selfie with the Social Media and Politics Podcast Geofilter. It's way cooler than sexting. Ask Anthony Weiner. All right, on to today's episode, which is about a grassroots progressive candidate challenging one of the most powerful figures in U.S. politics, Nancy Pelosi, who was former Speaker of the House and is currently the House Minority Leader for the Democrats. And my guest today is Preston Pickus, who is not a politician by trade, but a high school teacher and wrestling and football coach for the past 9 years. And Preston has also authored a book called Send Our Reps to Rehab, which is all about campaign finance reform. And he ran a progressive campaign as an independent against Nancy Pelosi and very interestingly beat the Republican challenger to Nancy Pelosi in the primaries. So what I wanted to ask Preston was, what role did social media have in his grassroots campaign, where he denied any funding from a super PAC? He only took donations under $540. And in the academic literature, at least, there's a lot about how social media really benefits either fringe political parties or fringe candidates who really have an incentive to adopt social media, or social media is seen, in theory at least, as a way to level the playing field between really mainstream popular candidates and lesser known candidates who are trying to break into an election. So it's a very interesting dynamic where you have a grassroots candidate who's farther to the left of the establishment candidate, very much in the way that Bernie Sanders was more left than Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton was the establishment favorite. She had the money. She had the super PACs. She had the DNC, where similar dynamics going on here, where Preston is a farther left progressive candidate than Nancy Pelosi. And I was interested in finding out, how did he use social media? Did it really level the playing field? Was it a way to close the gap between a grassroots candidate and the money and influence that has come to characterize U.S. politics today. So if you want to find out more about Preston and his campaign, his Facebook page is still very much active. He's still posting regularly. And you can find that by typing in Preston Pickus for Congress in the Facebook search box. That's Preston Pickus, P-I-C-U-S, for Congress. Preston, thanks so much for taking the time out, and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So let's give our listeners a little bit of context regarding your campaign, because it's a rather interesting case. You decided to run against one of the most well-known and powerful Democratic leaders in the U.S., Nancy Pelosi, in California's 12th congressional district, which is historically very blue and always votes Democratic. So what made you decide to run against such a powerful figure, and what were the major issues that you were pushing as an independent candidate?
You know, that's a question I got a lot. Why Nancy Pelosi? She's extremely powerful. She's extremely wealthy. I mean, we can all see how powerful she is. The Democrats took the worst beating that we've seen in a long time, and she maintained her position as House Minority Leader. But the truth is, I live in San Francisco. I live in the Bay Area. This is my home. And Nancy Pelosi was my representative. And so, you know, when I made the decision, I wrote a book back in 2011 called Send Our Reps to Rehab, in which I argued that the fundamental problem with our government is the interaction of money and elections. You have to raise $2.5 million to get elected to Congress, six to Senate, billion for president. And when you look at who's donating the money, 90% of the money is coming from the wealthiest 0.05%. So like extreme millionaires mm-hmm. are putting up the vast majority of the dollars. And Nancy Pelosi embodies that. She's worth $100 million herself. You know, so honestly, while an uphill battle, ideologically, it was sort of a perfect point. To me, Nancy Pelosi embodies the corruption and the dysfunction of our government, and people like her that are the reason why our government really works against the middle class and lower income Americans, and why our system is grinding itself. And you can see the evidence of this with things like the election of Donald Trump, with the huge disparity in income across the United States, and with the dysfunction of Congress just generally, their inability to do almost anything these days.
So as you were campaigning against the role of money and influence in U.S. politics, I guess you had a firsthand insight into the difficulties of overcoming not having so much resources as a grassroots candidate. So can you talk a little bit about your campaign organization and what type of advantages a big time player like Nancy Pelosi had in terms of resources?
Oh, sure. No, I mean, it's incredible the amount of power that you're up against. The first thing is just control of the media. So today, actually, there's a news story in San Francisco. We have two big newspapers, The Chronicle and The Examiner, but they're both owned by the same big corporation. And just today, the chief editor of The Examiner took a job as the chief of staff for the Board of Supervisors, this unpopular woman who has a lot of money and power. And so you see this intertwining. Years ago, Nancy Pelosi passed a bill or fought for a deregulatory effect, which allowed the Hearst Corporation to buy, I think, The Examiner when they already owned The Chronicle, whichever way it was. So now they're all one company. And so because of that, you know, that influence, that wealth that she's got, those connections, and I'm sure, you know, people at the Chronicle Examiner owe her, I couldn't get a single mention, which was really uncommon. Even the longest shot congressional opponent at least can get some local press. Interesting story. I'm a teacher. I'm running for Congress. I've written a couple books. Maybe I've got a cute daughter. Something would it normally get you some local press. But I got zero, not even a single mention. And the one time they did mention me was right before the election when they endorsed Pelosi. They lied about the election and said that the Republicans didn't run anybody. But the truth was the Republicans did. We have a top two election in California. I beat the Republican. First time an independent's done that in California. So it was really interesting. But right away, you're not going to get any media. And then second is just sort of like the obvious infrastructure stuff. I raised, I think, $30,000 or $40,000. With that, I had some really dedicated people, but they were all working full-time jobs and helping me on the side. I couldn't afford to pay full-time salaries for anybody. And so just my reach, Nancy Pelosi raising, you know, millions and millions and millions, she can have 10 people just sitting around thinking about things to do to stop our campaign if it ever came to that. Right now they're thinking about ways to, you know, steal money from regular Americans. But if I ever sort of became a threat and people started moving like it looks like we're going to in 2018, she'll have unlimited resources where I will be using, you know, volunteers. And volunteers are great. And the people that worked with the campaign were terrific. However, at some point, right, you have to make a living, and their job would have to come before their volunteer activities. And that just makes it's tough to compete with that kind of infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up this the idea of media access, and that kind of relates to what I wanted to ask you about on this show, which is the role of digital and social media in your campaign, because that's kind of, at least in the academic literature, seen as a way to kind of circumvent the power of the media in setting the agenda, or a way to give smaller candidates more access directly to voters. So how important was social media in getting out your message, and do you think it closed the gap a bit in terms of the difference in resources between you and the Pelosi campaign?
You know, so that's really hard to say. Ever since you and I talked about I'd come on your podcast and discuss this, you know, I've been reflecting on it, and you know, there's some pluses for sure. Facebook is a great resource at times, but it has its limits. So for instance, I can post something on Facebook and for free, you know, my 10,000 followers can maybe see it depending on how it fits in the algorithm and all this kind of stuff. But it's only certain kinds of things. So if I post original content, a lot of times that's going to get viewed less than if I repost something that's already sort of popular on Facebook. And the thing that's important to keep in mind, social media was, you know, no doubt I spent way more time and attention on social media than anything else. We didn't have the money to take out full page ads in the newspaper. Radio is really ineffective because, especially in the Bay Area, there's four or five congressional districts all real close together. So would I be reaching my voters? Would I be reaching the voters, you know, across the Bay? These are all kind of tough. Where YouTube, especially with their targeting, you can target people right in your congressional district. And then Facebook, you can, you know, choose how you target. And so those ad buys, I think they are effective. I think they're more effective than more traditional means of media. But on the other end, you have to keep in mind, Facebook is a corporation that just wants to make profit from keeping you paying attention to things. So I could say the most important thing in the world, whatever it is, but if it's not going to be popular, or if it's not going to keep people looking at Facebook longer, Facebook isn't going to choose to show that to you. So there's a big handicap, and especially as they become more sophisticated, you know, Facebook's very sophisticated in its way that it keeps you looking, right? They do huge amounts of research. How can we make you look for 5 more seconds or 10 more seconds or 1 more minute? And so that's a handicapping feature even for, you know, something grassroots and sort of populist.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, because Mark Zuckerberg has kind of taken a calculated step over the past couple of years to basically cut the organic reach that you get on public pages. So whereas before your followers might see everything that you post, now estimates put it somewhere at between 5 to 20%, with the idea being the business model, if you pay, then you'll be able to reach all of your subscribers. So I guess there's the argument you made that if you had more resources, you could have micro-targeted more effectively. But this is something that I guess the Pelosi campaign had, the campaign machine, whereas you were relying on small donations, right?
Correct. Right. I mean, so, you know, we spent on the order of maybe 25% of our money on advertisement with Facebook and YouTube. And, you know, it is pretty effective. And what's really interesting is I had people working on the page, and there's that gratification, right? You post something and then it's liked 100 times. And that's great. That's gratifying. And then if you pay $10, Facebook will get 500 more people to like it for you. So that's more gratifying, right? But then you always have to ask, what did it do? What did those Facebooks like do? Like, were we achieving our outreach goals? Did we get more people to sort of register in their brains to vote for me? Or did we just simply gratify ourselves by getting, you know, 5,000 likes or something by paying some money? And the other thing that was interesting to me is we paid some money at some point. We were at like 8,000 likes. And for appearances, the team decided we should pay Facebook to find more people to like our page. So I think we paid, I forget, maybe $500 for more likes. And we got to 10,000 because it changes the way that it looks on your page. But our reach didn't dramatically increase. You know, you would assume that we'd see a 25% increase in engagement and reach, and it still stayed sort of similar. It really just depends on what we're posting, when we're posting, you know, how many people are engaging with it, how many people are sharing it is obviously the biggest thing. If you can get people to share, they're sort of doing that organic thing for you. But yeah, I mean, Facebook is not the Wild West that it used to be, where you throw anything up and people could see it. And even Twitter for a long time was every single thing that anybody's ever tweeted, which it still sort of is, but now it does this like while you're away feature. So it gives you maybe 15 or 20 tweets that, you know, could be from the last couple of days from people that you typically engage with, all in an effort to sort of get you to be more engaged with Twitter. Twitter, you know, I think is useless in terms of social media and outreach. People buy followers, people buy likes. It's pretty easy to manipulate. And the one thing that I do notice that it does is if you tweet something really interesting, maybe a news source will talk about your tweet. That seems to be the effect of Twitter, right? Some news source will talk about Donald Trump's tweet, or some news source will talk about a tweet battle between, you know, two popular figures. But if you're trying to reach people, we paid for a small amount of advertising with them, and it was truly ineffective. But as a platform, I guess they've got a different angle on things.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on what you were saying about Facebook. So I was looking at both your and Nancy Pelosi's Congress page, and it's kind of interesting because you had a Pecos for Congress and she had a Pelosi for Congress, and they had a section where people could write endorsements. So it was definitely something kind of particular to a political page. So what I want to ask is there any special process for setting up a sort of Facebook campaign account? Like, did you have to kind of have some official registration, or was it just the same as setting up a public page for a website or a company?
No, you know, so what's funny is if you click on that public endorsements, right? If you go to Nancy Pelosi's, she has no public endorsements there yet. I have no public endorsements. Facebook just like added that, I think like maybe a month or two ago, and sent me an email saying, we've added public endorsements. And I think they basically went through every business page that was set up. And if you checked politician, then they sent you this email saying, set up your endorsements. But I don't know that anybody has. There was a big battle for a little while. There were companies contacting me, and I, their names elude me now, but they wanted me to go and sign up my campaign with their page, and they were going to do all this stuff. They were going to, you know, basically be the Facebook of politics, which maybe some of them started to capitalize and gain some traction in the market, and Facebook realized, well, we better just make sure that we are the Facebook of politics. And so they kind of did this extra step. But yeah, no, there's really, that's the other thing that's sort of interesting, is there's no metric. The blue check mark is like their one metric or gold standard, which I haven't really pursued getting it. But other than that, you know, anybody can create a page calling it anything. And I mean, you could go start your own Pecos for Congress page and then just start saying anything you want. And I'm not even sure how I would stop you from doing that. So they don't seem to really regulate much in terms of users creating business pages.
Mm. Yeah, and I kind of linking to this idea of being a sort of big time candidate versus a grassroots candidate. On episode 6 of this podcast, we were talking to one of the digital strategists who was working with Rand Paul's presidential bid. And he was saying that they were in almost daily contact with Facebook and Google in order to devise ways to drive engagement and to further their reach. So, did you have any sort of similar contact with Facebook?
No, no. I'm sure you have to spend millions with them to get that kind of service. And we spent, you know, we're a very small customer for Facebook. Rand Paul probably raised, you know, $20 million, $30 million when he was running. And he probably spent maybe $2 or $3 million with Facebook. So for that, they'll probably designate you two or three people that will, you know, check in with you every day. Like with any service, I have friends who are leaders in the tech community and they run big enterprises, and they talk about a similar sort of interaction with Facebook. But, you know, it's like with any service. If you're selling, you know, shoes and I'm buying thousands a pair, you're going to make sure somebody's checking in with me. If I'm buying two or three at a time, well, you're going to let me wander in the store whenever, you know, I sort of happen to come by.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about promoting posts and things of that nature. How did you go about coming up with those strategies then, if you didn't have an official contact person? Did you sort of brainstorm ideas, or did you draw some inspiration from the tech industry there in Silicon Valley, or how did it work?
Yeah, so I was fortunate to meet a couple, Margie Foster and Erickson Foster. They run a marketing firm. If any of your listeners are interested, give them my contact, maybe put my contact on there somewhere.
Sure.
So they can get in touch with me. But they, Margie ran our ground game on our social media, and she used, you know, there are ways of doing it if you work with a lot of intelligence. So on the small budget that I gave her, she actually got huge bang for the buck. And when you know, I was researching, you know, what were the CPMs for basic ads, and we were basically at triple or quadruple what the average cost is. So we did really well in terms of our targeting. And she ran, you know, I know a variety. I know, you know, sometimes she would boost a post. So a post that we already did that was popular. Sometimes we ran just ads on Facebook so that, you know, it would come up on your feed as sponsored. And I think that those, depending on what you're trying to do, those can be really successful. But, you know, Margie, really, she designed these things, and on a shoestring budget, I mean, we had some pretty good engagement for how little money that we ended up spending overall.
Yeah, and kind of keeping on engagement, when I was looking at your page, your post would typically get somewhere in the range of 40 to 500 likes. Is that right?
So during the campaign, it was actually a bit higher. I don't know if you can go back, but it was maybe like in the 2 to 5,000 range. We would get up to maybe like 3 or 4,000 was like some of our biggest. We had our biggest one is pinned. That one is our biggest. I think it's got like 15,000 likes or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about, because there was this one post in particular that you posted the day after the election that got 15,000 likes and almost 2,000 shares. And that was in reference to Bernie Sanders being sort of disadvantaged in the primary campaign at the expense of Hillary Clinton. Any idea how that post was able to reach such a larger audience than your other posts?
Yeah, well, so that was actually posted, I think, you know, so it must have been just after midnight on election day on November 7th. And the post reads, "While everyone is stressing and sweating and worrying about a Trump presidency, all I can think is that if the Democrat Party hadn't rigged the primary, Bernie Sanders would be coasting to an easy victory right now." And I think that post was so popular because it captured that moment perfectly for so many of us in this country that, you know, when I campaigned for Bernie Sanders and when we tried to push against the liberal establishment and the Democrat Party, there was all this pushback. You know, you remember the superdelegates. Mm-hmm. They all went for Hillary right away, this unprecedented number, because she's the only electable one. She's the only one that can win this election. And then as you kind of fought, and, you know, Bernie Sanders, who is this nothing, nobody senator from Vermont with, you know, these crazy ideas about, you know, socialism and all this kind of stuff, as he gained popularity and they suppressed him at every turn, a huge number of Americans, millions and millions of Americans who supported Bernie Sanders felt disenfranchised. We looked and we said, well, why is every debate on Saturday night? Normally the debates are on like Tuesday or Wednesday. And they said, oh, well, that's for our own reasons. And then finally the emails come out. Debbie Wasserman Schultz was cheating. She's a cheater. She's a corrupt liar and a cheater. And instead of, you know, anybody in the Democrat Party saying, okay, you know what, guys, you were right, that was pretty messed up, they ignored us. They continued to harass the Bernie Sanders faction at DNC meetings. They put Donna Brazile, who's another entirely corrupt person, at the top. And look, they just now, instead of electing Keith Ellison, who in my opinion is barely progressive, but at least was a good start, they put in Perez. And so the Democrats just continued to ignore tens of millions of voters. And then they lost the election. And everybody starts looking at each other saying, well, what happened? Well, what happened was you told, I don't know, 100 million people to piss off. And you did it over and over. And you said, piss off. Or what are you going to do? You're going to let Trump win? And then you did it enough where, you know, if you look at the numbers, Trump didn't. There wasn't this huge surge of voters for Trump. Trump got about as many votes as Romney. And he got about as many votes as McCain. It's this portion of the population that's always going to vote for the Republican president no matter what. But Hillary had a substantial minus. Just 5 or 6 million more people who voted for Obama in 12 didn't come out and vote. And that was this thing that they did. And they're continuing to do. So I think at that moment, at that evening, you know, people across the country who were watching this sort of orange fascist clown, you know, wind his way toward the presidency, and we're always being sort of talked down to by this Hillary Clinton faction. Oh, you stupid idiots. Bernie Sanders couldn't have won. Hillary Clinton's the only candidate. And then she loses because she's corrupt, because she's establishment, because she's everything that the growing number of angry and upset Americans hate in politics. You know, and they didn't go vote for Trump. They just stayed home. They couldn't pull the lever for somebody as bad as Clinton. So I posted that maybe at 12:30. I kind of predicted that Trump was going to win a little earlier in the night. Much to the chagrin of the people who were at my house watching the election results with me. And I think people still feel that way. Today, I'm still talking about the fact that, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and these Democrats are saying, stay the course. We're not going to change anything. It's all about messaging. It's all about Russia. And they're going to lose again. They're going to lose the midterms in 2018. And if they don't change, then you're going to have 8 years of Trump over here. So we're in some trouble.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about the kind of Bernie Sanders aspect of your campaign, because you seem to run on a platform. I don't know ideologically how similar it was, but you promoted your candidacy at pro Bernie Sanders rallies, and that seemed to drive some traction to your campaign. So can you talk a little bit about that? Was that a calculated strategy, or what was the connection between you and the Sanders platform?
Well, so, you know, if you want the honest truth, I called Bernie Sanders staff in 12. And begged him to run against Obama. I wanted Obama to get primary. I was pissed off about NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, which allows for indefinite detainment of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil by the government as long as they're declared terrorists. So, you know, an erosion of our civil rights. I was pissed off about the Wall Street giveaways that Obama orchestrated. I was mad that he had Larry Summers as his chief economic advisor, a guy who is a pathetic piece of trash and, you know, a racist, misogynistic jerk. I felt Obama was a failure. This hope and change thing, it turned out to be, corporate giveaways and a re-strengthening of Wall Street's grip on the throat of the American people. So I wanted Bernie to run in 08. I've just admired him for a long time. He's an independent. I'm an independent. The guy has been on the right side of history for a long time. In the 60s, you know, you get pictures of him getting beaten up and arrested, you know, protesting for civil rights and things like that. While Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton were going to their extravagant dinners and breaking strike lines. So I've admired him. You know, he's a politician, so he's not infallible. I don't worship him, you know, but he's a very good politician. So anyway, I decided to run for Congress in 2016. And then there were some rumblings. And then when Bernie Sanders declared, you know, a few months later, I was like, well, this is obvious. So I endorsed him right away. Back, I think, when Jon Stewart was calling him a cuckoo bird. And it was sort of this joke that this, you know, old Jewish socialist was going to run against the most powerful, wealthy candidate in history or something like this. And so then as it kind of took off, because people are pissed, they're pissed about the political establishment and how they don't care about Americans. Actually, they actively fight against this. People started showing up at these rallies. And so I'll be honest, I don't think I would have been as successful as I was beating the Republican had it not been for the Bernie Sanders rallies. I was at a rally one time with 20,000 people, and I brought 15 staff, and we canvassed the entire thing. We must have talked to, you know, 10 to 15,000 people that day just in one day. So it was a massive movement. A populist uprising, and I think it was important, and I'm hoping that some of that can continue. It's been sort of disappointing to see, you know, some of these groups like Our Revolution and a couple others are kind of just trying to fold back into the Democrat establishment, and you know, I don't know what it's going to take for these people to learn, but you know, most Americans, I don't care how scared you try to make them of Trump, they're not going to come back and vote for these corrupt Democrats. They're going to need to do something new, and Bernie Sanders was trying to do that, and you know, I admired him for trying.
And when you would meet these pro-Bernie supporters when you were out campaigning at his events, did you find that they were generally younger, or did they really kind of cross the demographic spectrum?
Oh, all over the place, all kinds, all shapes, all colors, all everything. The very similar. I went to some Trump protests as well, and just a very similar energy and demographic. So the Bernie Bros narrative was a very sneaky move, but you know, politics is sneaky, and the Clinton campaign defines sneakiness. But the idea that it's like all like white college boys supporting Bernie was crazy, but it did play on the narrative, something that I dealt with as well as a white guy running against a woman, and you know, living in a patriarchal society where women have been on the bad end of the stick for centuries, for millennia. You know, it does feel a little bit weird going after a woman, but when the woman is, I don't care if you're a man, woman, whatever, if you're corrupt, you're corrupt. And if you're damaging the United States, you're damaging the United States. And Clinton and Pelosi certainly embody that, you know, along with, you know, their friends Schumer and Perez and Podesta and all these guys. But, you know, I supported Nader back in 2000. And, you know, everybody's so upset still because they think Gore would have won if Nader hadn't run or whatever. And I'm not a Green Party supporter. I just liked Nader. And I went back to those rallies, and I think I saw him at Madison Square Garden. When I was at Columbia, I went to a Madison Square Garden thing that they put on. And it was really exciting, but it didn't have the energy that this Bernie Sanders thing did. It was good. I think Eddie Vedder played, and I really like Pearl Jam. But this Bernie Sanders thing just had so much more ferocity to it and so much more sort of palpable political momentum than even Nader in 2000.
Do you think, kind of thinking about the theme of this show, do you think that has anything to do with these online communication technologies, social media, blogs, where people can more easily share opinions, but also organize offline? So I'm assuming that you used Facebook to some extent to organize your events, right?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. So that's hard to argue with. The I went down to LA to do an event that was standing with Standing Rock, but there was a bunch of different things incorporated in it, and there were some people there who were getting their pictures taken with everyone, and I thought they were movie stars, but you know, maybe I just didn't know what movies or whatever. So I asked the guy who had brought me down there. I said, "Who are these people?" And this guy in particular, and he says, "Oh, he's Bernie famous." Right? That was a term they were using in LA. Bernie famous, which you know meant somebody who had gained popularity over social media during the Bernie campaign and sort of found ways to maintain it, and then would, you know, probably go on CNN or MSNBC or things like this. So no, 100%. The amount of people, that is one truth of social media that I don't think Facebook has found a way to get around yet, but millions and millions of people interested in something can now go around our traditional forms of media. You know, millions of people who are interested in Bernie Sanders don't need MSNBC. They don't need Fox News. They don't need CNN. You know, they can go around and find each other and share information far easier on the internet. And I think maybe in the future we'll have, you know, more places for this, but right now Facebook is the place where you go. Something enrages you, something you find interesting, you share it on Facebook, your friends see it, their friends see it, and our social networks, and especially now as we sort of self-select right into our group. So people who like my page, they probably like Bernie Sanders. So when I say something about Pelosi being corrupt, they will cheer. And when I say something about, you know, Trump being a jerk, they will cheer. And when I say something nice about Bernie, you know, and so they kind of self-select and then they'll share with their people that they've self-selected with. So big groups of people can get together very easily on Facebook at this time. And I would say, you know, without social media, the Bernie thing is impossible. He didn't have the money in the beginning. And he raised most of that money on small donations from people who probably found out about him from their friend on Facebook or Twitter.
And did that influence the messages that you decided to post, knowing that your supporters were kind of had these pro-Bernie sentiments or anti-Trump sentiments? I mean, were you able to capitalize on that, or did you try to capitalize on that, where putting out pro-Bernie messages or anti-Trump messages because you know that's what would be shared and drive engagement?
Yeah, so you have to balance that, right? Because at some point, I'm just part of the cacophony, right? I'm another add to the echo. So you have to distinguish yourself. And so one of the reasons why I'm probably not very good at politics is I don't like lying and I don't like saying stupid things just to get attention. If I had those qualities, I think I would be in Congress right now. But you definitely do use strategy. You take a look at what's happening. The most important thing you can do in social media is figure out what is happening or what's going to happen next. Like, what is the next thing that they're going to get into the cycle? Because it's a cycle. You know, like, you look at this thing that happened with Rachel Maddow, this stupid thing she did with Trump's tax returns, right? She goes on TV. She says, I'm going to, very Glenn Beck-ish, right? I'm going to release his tax returns tonight. Social media goes crazy. What could it be? Twitter fires up, right? And when Twitter fires up, it's all these, like, pro-Trump people, like, yelling F you, and then all these, like, you know, anti-Trump people yelling at you and the whole thing. And then it turns out, what does she have? She has like two pages that proves he made a lot of money and he paid some taxes in 2005. And the whole thing is still going. If you go on social media right now, now people are arguing about who won. Did Rachel Maddow win? Did Trump win? You know, like who won this battle? And that'll go on for another day or two. And then they'll go into the next thing. So it certainly cycles. And being a part of that cycle is important. But also finding an interesting or original way of being part of that cycle is the only way to gather attention. You can get tweeted and retweeted a trillion times, but if nobody's engaging with you, right, if nobody's learning about Preston Pickett for Congress or Michael Bassetta or whatever it is that you're actually about, then it's all just part of the echo.
Mm-hmm. And so last question has to do with the Pickett for Congress page now, because it's still very active. So it seems that you have acquired this base of about 10,000 people or this audience of 10,000 people, but you're still very active in using that page. So can you talk a little bit about what your motivations are for sort of staying on Facebook after the campaign and kind of what's next?
Yeah, well, you know, I lost, so I don't give up and go home. I'm deeply worried about the future of this country. And, you know, I've been saying it for years. So, you know, I'm not retreating from the field. Well, first I'll say, it's strategy. If you don't post on your Facebook page, let's say I go 2 weeks and nobody posts. I have a few people that post things on the Facebook page and respond to messages. The next thing you post will get very little engagement. It'll be viewed for our page by about maybe 2,000 people. If I've already posted three or four times that week, that next post will still get about 25 to 30,000 people seeing it. So you have to, it's kind of like the old, you know, for academics, right? Publish or die, right? And it's the same in the social media world. Keep publishing or you become irrelevant and the algorithm has trouble finding you. But then additionally, I built a substantial following on Facebook and emails. I get a lot of emails and phone calls. And I am interested in helping people, progressives, run for Congress. And right now I'm working with several. We're going to probably announce the list in June when they declare. But my goal is to have 10 to 15 candidates running on a progressive platform to take on folks here in California. And the reason California is a great place for this is we have 53 congressional districts. For your listeners who don't know about American government, we have 435 members in the U.S. House. And the U.S. House is the most powerful body in government. When you look at the Constitution, everything has to come through the U.S. House. But because it's so powerful, U.S. House members have to run for election every 2 years. And that's designed so that if you don't like what's going on in government, you should be able to just vote out the House, get a new group of representatives in there, and they'll do things that are better. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. We have 97% incumbency rate, even though Congress has like a 9% or 7% approval rating or whatever. So I believe that we can change the country by changing Congress. And in California, we have a top two open primary system, which means in June, everybody runs. And then the top two vote getters, regardless of party, so it could be two Republicans, two Democrats, a Green and an independent. I was an independent. I went against a Democrat. And only those two move on to the general election, which prevents the big fear in our country, which is by running against Democrats, you'll help Republicans. So by knocking out the Republicans in the June primary, my progressive candidates, our progressive candidates on our team, will be able to take on Democrats in a one-on-one challenge that won't result in the Republican winning. For instance, in Maryland, if you run as an independent, you'll go and there'll be a Democrat, there'll be a Republican, there'll be a Green, there'll be a Libertarian, there'll be each one of these. And so if you do well, what you'll do is siphon votes off from the Democrat and help the Republican win. In California, we won't do that. So in 2018, I want to help 10 to 15 candidates run, and that's going to require some people paying attention. And so in the meantime, I'll continue to use the resources on social media to try to keep people motivated and fired up. And paying attention to the things they should be paying attention to. And hopefully when the time comes, those people will come out and support our good progressive candidates for Congress.
Cool. Well, best of luck with it. And Preston, thanks so much for taking the time out. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
I've just been speaking with Preston Pickus, congressional candidate in the latest U.S. election for California's 12th district. To find out more about Preston and his message, you can check out his Facebook page, Preston Pickus for Congress. And that's all the time we have for this episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Remember, if you want us to target your school or university with our Snapchat filter in the U.S., just send us a tweet at SMNPPodcast or write us a message on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Social Media and Politics Podcast. Thanks to everyone who's helped out so far with the podcast, Peter Orbeck, Copenhagen College Radio, and Mom. Love you, Mom. I'm Michael Bassetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.